Hi, everyone. My name is David Palmer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Chris and I took a brief five-year break since we left off with the 10th step in March of 2014. Chris had moved, was on his process of moving to Colorado, and I was in the process of getting divorced. A lot has happened since then. Clearly, you'll see an immense amount of spiritual growth from one of us, or both of us, maybe. And we're going to pick up on page 82 tonight, and we're going to start with the 11th step. And it's in the original manuscript. You can follow along in the big book if you'd like, or if you have the maroon copy, you can follow along in the original manuscript. We're going to kind of bounce back and forth between the original manuscript and the big book. Tonight, I think we're just going to probably stay in the original manuscript. You know, one of the things I'd like to actually talk a little bit before we start, since we stopped the workshop for the original manuscript, a lot has changed in my life. One of the things that changed in my life was I went back to school, basically because my children had a resentment, and they had told me that why do we have to go to college if you never finished? And I was like, well, the hell with you, I'll finish, right? And you know, it's the basis of all the resentments in my life that wonderful things have happened. And I ended up going back to school, and I've learned a lot. But more importantly, I've kind of learned what's happened for me is things have fallen into place that I would never have thought were out of place, right? Now, I'll tell you a very brief story about a partner that I used to have. His name was Rob. And Rob and I were in business in the early 90s in the software business, and he was a great partner. And he turned to me one day, he goes, and I was learning programming at the time, I was learning C programming. And C programming is very linear. You do one thing, you wait for it to finish, and you do another, right? And at the time, what was coming out was the C++ programming, which was you can do a lot of things at once. And my partner turned to me and goes, Dave, you're just learning C. I would just forget that and go learn C++. Well, I figured I had like, you know, 4 weeks invested in C. Why give that up? And just a month ago, I made a decision to give that up. Now, 1992 until now, it took me to realize that guy was right. But it wasn't the programming thing that made me realize just how right he was, right? It was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, because I continue to find in so many places in my life where I hold on to old ideas, right, to my own detriment. It has been the hallmark of my recovery that I wake up one day thinking that I'm a recovered alcoholic of superior spirituality and realize I'm some idiot who has held on to another thing when I should have let it go. And the funny thing is I've kind of learned what that looks like. There's this kind of Don McCready thing where you get a little bit of information. Do you remember your first like 7 weeks in AA? You get a little bit of information and you're rewriting the big book. Well, I'm gonna handle steps 13 through 24. I'm gonna probably ask my sponsor to help me. And then there's the imposter problem, which is when you actually become an expert in something and you no longer believe yourself. You somehow doubt your own validity. You somehow think somewhere along the line that you've got to be fake. You can't have actually reached this point. My trajectory in Alcoholics Anonymous has been Don McCready, Don McCready, Don McCready, Don McCready, Don McCready. Imposter Don McCready. And it's been like that. It has continued to kind of unfold for me where I continue to make mistakes and believe that I know the right thing. The thing that changed for me, the thing that really kind of opened my eyes occurred with, I think Mark and Jill were in my living room that fall in 2011 when we were doing a big book workshop at my house. And I suddenly realized that after 26 years, I didn't have God, right? That I'd always kind of wanted to have God as long as I didn't look bad having God. Did you ever want to have God and not look bad or get into fights over it, right? And I suddenly realized this, that the thing that I'd been holding on to was this intellectual pride that I had to know God, right? I had to know what God looked like. I had to understand God. I had to put God in a book or put it on the table or look at God and understand every aspect of God. And it was in this moment when we were going through the big book and we were talking about being on the bridge and we agnostics and reaching out for the fellows on the other you know shore, and just not being able to step off the bridge because we're attached, right, to some idea about what God should be, and being afraid to actually have what I see now for myself, and I don't know that you should see it this way, but faith, which in the absence of information works perfectly. Whereas I have been trying to get new information all along. I have been trying to stuff my head full of information. And the process that had happened for me for the 2 years prior to that moment was I had gone on this spiritual journey, because it was the one thing that I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't have, was I didn't have God. Right? I would tell you I had God. I would pray to who? Who knows? Right? And I went off in this kind of journey of trying to find out who the heck God was. The funny thing was, this all started in the 11th step. Because I had to present on the 11th step, and I thought, well, Christ, I don't really have a relationship with God. It's going to be kind of hard to talk about prayer and meditation when you don't know who you're praying to. So I started to go around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and started to ask people, what does your disciplines look like, right? What does 10 and 11 look like for you? And I'd roll up on the guy who sounded good at the meetings, and he'd give me a pitch about what, you know, his deal was. And I go, that's wonderful, right? Then I go ask somebody else, and they tell me something, and that was wonderful, right? And all I'm doing is judging everybody, walking around, collecting information, and judging everybody. And then I go to this meeting, it's a morning meeting on Sunday, I forget where it is, it's like in Island. It was this, it's kind of a biggish meeting, and there's all these circular tables, but I got there early, and there was some people milling about, and there was this one woman off in this one table in the corner, and she had on her right side a younger woman. She was a little bit older. And on her left side, a younger woman also. And they had like big books or 12 and 12s or whatever. And she was knitting. Now, if you ever want to get judged by me, bring a newspaper or knitting into a meeting. Right? Anybody ever do that? Like, oh, hey, Karen. I didn't see that. Oh, jeez. You're judgment free.
Okay, thank you.
But, you know, so I walk in. Right. I walk in with this kind of arrogance about me. Like, I have surveyed everybody of importance in AA, right? And asked them what their disciplines look like, right? And I still haven't gotten my answer. So I said, I'll ask her just to kind of round out the survey. You know, like, I'll knock on all the doors. And I go over and I start talking to this woman. And I said to her, I said, you know, you have a minute? She goes, sure. I said, what do your disciplines look like? You know, what do you do for 10 and 11? Now, here's the funny thing. She told me in a very quiet, unassuming manner. She spoke for maybe a minute and a half. I don't remember a single thing she said. But it blew me away. At the time, it completely blew away everything I ever thought about what this was supposed to look like. And it basically came down to, I talk and I listen with my heart. And I'm like, oh, okay, so there's like no procedures, there's no special thing you do, you don't ring bells, you don't have incense, there's no singing bowls, you know, you don't have your closet with burning candles and chicken feet. You know, what do you, you know? She goes, I talk and I listen with my heart. I'm like, crap. Right? It was too easy. It was too easy. That began a 2-year process of reading literature, investigating religious activities, following up on this, following up on that. I was on the internet doing research, and I came across this Tibetan monk who had been imprisoned by the Chinese for 31 years, and he gets out. He escapes, actually. Makes it across the Himalayas, right? Just picture this. 31 years in a prison, escapes across the Himalayas, right? Ends up in front of the Dalai Lama for tea, because I guess if you escape out of Chinese prison, the Dalai Lama wants to have tea with you. And the Dalai Lama asks him, were you ever afraid? And what was his name? I can't remember. But the monk says, yes, I was afraid 3 times. And the Dalai Lama says to him, oh, you never have to be afraid of death. And the monk says, oh, no, Dalai, I was never afraid of death. I was afraid of losing my compassion for the Chinese torturers. I went, oh, shit, I got a long way to go. I don't know about you, but I'm planning their demise sitting here in Westfield. You know, I mean, oh, my God. And you start to read about these people, you know, Mother Teresa taking shoes that didn't fit her so that nobody else had to endure that pain. Things that I would just never do. I'm pushing the weak and the infirm out of the way to get to the truck to get to the better shoes. You know, that's, God, what am I going to do here? And I start thinking about what it is to me to be spiritual. What does Bill want from me? Right? What is Bill asking us throughout the book? Right? And the idea is to set aside these kind of old ideas. Back to the Don McCready thing. I don't know how to do that. My alcoholism doesn't want me to know. My alcoholism says to me, oh, Dave, you're thinking about that? Look over there. Right? Look at the shine. I got a laser, you know, pointer. You'd be like a cat, Dave. We don't want you to think about how to give up old ideas because the old ideas work for us. Right? So I started to go into this process of looking at how to shed myself of these ideas that I think were right. Now, I grew up, quote unquote, or I lived through, you know, Tammy Faye Baker and you know, the spiritual condos, and you know, and for those of you who are a little bit older in this room, you remember that it was a big, you know, it was a big thing on TV, and you know, they got in trouble for that. They'd raised money for their church and sold condos and kept the money, or some, or oversold the condos, I forget. But it was always this thing, and Bill talks about it in the book about how I judge others. Right? All I need is one failure. I only need one failure. If I get that one failure, I'm right. I am the expert with that information. I am Don McCready. It proves my point. So I started to ask myself in this process, what is it, Dave, that you believe is true? So I started to look at what I believed was true. Now, here's the funny thing. In the light of day, when I looked at these things and really wanted to know whether or not something was true or not for me, it doesn't have to be true or not for you, things started to fall away, piece by piece, and large chunks started to disappear. And I started to find out that the things that I'd always thought were important, always held on, all the things that needed to be in place for me to be someplace where it would be safe in my mind, where I could put you into your little cubbyhole and know that I was okay. And I started doing a morning and a nightly routine in 2009 and started to go into like real serious prayer and meditation. And I didn't know how to do it. And Chris had a great idea because he started working with me in 2009. He goes, well, why don't you get a meditation for dummies? I thought, that's a great idea, Chris. I bought it. I never read it. You know, I bought a lot of books on a lot of things that I've never read. And but it was that woman at that meeting who was knitting who said it's about asking and then listening. And that kind of made sense to me. Because I didn't know how to ask, right? Because I always thought you'd look stupid if you asked, right? If you don't know right away, then who are you, right? And this comes from my being in school and never getting it from reading. I recently found out, by the way, that I had this reading deficit. I am dyslexic. I found this out just within the last month. I am 96% of America has better reading comprehension than me. Which should make you feel very secure that we're doing a big book workshop. And 84% of America reads faster than I do. So not only do I not understand what I'm reading, I've got to read it 5 or 6 times just to catch up. But the other thing about that understanding that I now have of myself is that throughout my entire school life, I always felt less than, right? Because I wasn't getting what everybody else was getting, because only 5 or 10% of America suffers from this condition. And that was the thing, right? So I didn't want to ask questions because I always had questions and I always felt stupid. So what do? I go into prayer and meditation on a daily basis, morning and night. And I started to hate myself because I would miss. Anybody here ever try to do an 11-step at night and then like have your head on the pillow and go, God damn it. I didn't sit at my special desk with my special pen and my special cream-colored paper and my spiritual literature open, you know, with that candle burning. And damn, well, I'm not getting out of bed now. Anybody ever get into a routine and then wake up on the weekend and forgot to do the routine? Right. So I found out that there was a way that I could always ensure that I did an 11-step both morning and night, because the book doesn't say the last thing before you go to bed, or you know, although it does kind of say, you know, first thing when you get up, but we'll talk about that in a minute. But I started to do it in New Jersey Transit. Now, if you want to practice prayer and meditation, find some place noisy, disruptive, and you will become a pro at asking and listening, right? Because it's so hard when they're announcing, you know, disruptions and asking for tickets. And I got to the point where I was doing about 15 minutes going in and 15 minutes coming home. And because I caught the very early train, the 5:15 train or the 5:45 train, it was basically upon awakening, right? And I would write every morning and every night coming home, reviewing my day, following the exact steps in the book, which we're going to go over now. And my life started to change. Not because I had a routine, but because I was actually willing to hear new things in my life. I didn't even realize at the time that I started to detach from old ideas. Because I was desperate. 2009 had been 24 years since I'd come in the rooms, and I didn't have God. Right? Now, if you want to talk about slow learners, I am your poster boy. Right? If you're having trouble with God in this room, talk to me. It wouldn't be until 2006 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in my living room, you know, with Mark and Jill in the room. I don't remember if anybody else was there, but where I suddenly realized that I had been trying to be in control of the process of knowing God as opposed to just having faith that God existed, right? And when I let go of the idea that I had to know something about this, that was somehow important as opposed to just having faith, the absence of knowledge, everything changed that moment. But it took a long time of shedding these old ideas of what God could or could not look like for me. So, page 82, when we retire at night, step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. This is page 82, so step 11. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Now, who here has been under the impression that the constructively requires a grid downloaded from the internet and printed out and gone through with check marks at the end of the day? Anybody? I did for a long time. In fact, I went out and tried to collect all the grids to see which was the best. Apparently, there's a set of directions in the fourth step which would give you a good starting point. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest? Do we owe an apology? Right? All these things that the book asks us to look at. Constructively reviewing my day doesn't mean that I have to start on a new inventory process where I write down, Dave. Annoyed me, right? Didn't bow to me when he walked in the room. What does that affect? It affects him, not me.
I tried, you were talking something.
Okay. And the other thing about this kind of constructively reviewing the day, what I did, right, was I didn't know how to constructively review anything. Who here looks at themselves and say, "You're an idiot. You screwed up." Right? If those are the first words out of your mouth, in your mind at least, isn't that reminiscent of the one person you wouldn't want to hang out with? But I can't leave me, right? So constructively is saying, where was I good? Where did I add value? Where could I have done better? Another one of the things that's going to be asked in these pages. Where could I have done better for those around me? Right? Constructively for me was an evolution. Constructively for me didn't require me to know that there was a certain... I actually at one point went out and looked for the Oxford Group, an Oxford Group 11th step. And I found one. Someone sent it to me. And I always try to get to the basic roots of where we came from to understand what might be appropriate to kind of look at and how I can kind of constructively take a look at what I was doing. In the end, it became a very simple process. Everything that I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous that is spiritual is boiled down to the simplest possible phrasing or understanding. Constructively means that at the end of the night, I will have built upon my experiences in my connection to God.
My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
It's after 5 years. It's really good to be back here. This meeting has meant a lot to me over the years. When we broke off at step 10, I was like Dave said, I was moving out to Colorado. Now, when you move, if you've been around AA enough, you know there's a real risk about moving to another area because they're not going to do it the way you do it. They're going to be doing it wrong. You're not going to know anybody. Everybody's going to ignore you, and you're just going to stop going to meetings. And because that happens probably half the time AA members move. So I made a decision before that happened that I'm going to go. It's just going to be a discipline. I don't care how bad the meetings are. I'm going to go. So I move out there, and I'm in this town called Broomfield, which is, I think it was a little bit north of Denver. And I go to the nearest meeting. The first night I'm there, I go to the nearest meeting. Now, my spiritual lineage goes like this. A man named Joe Hawk took me through the steps in 2001 and 2002. He was taken through the steps by a man named Don Pritz in like 1985, 86. Don Pritz got sober in a group called the Denver Young People's Group at the York Street Clubhouse in the middle of Denver. And so from like 1970 to like 1985, there was some unbelievable stuff going on in that Denver area. I kind of knew this, but I wasn't expecting anything. I show up, I go to the nearest meeting I can, and I walk in, and it's a big book workshop, almost like what we're doing here tonight. Somebody is presenting out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous for about 45 minutes, and then there's 15 minutes of sharing and questions. And the person that was doing it was a man named David, whose sponsor was Don Pritz. And I was blown away. I was like, oh my God, you know, it could not have been better. And I found that there was just a great meeting after a great meeting out there. There were so many people. There were every single meeting, it didn't matter if it was a discussion meeting or whatever, they would start with a quote out of the big book at these meetings. And I don't think I saw 12 and 12 for a year and a half that I was out there. So that was a good experience. Then that job ended, and I picked up a job in Connecticut, and I moved to a town called Meriden, Connecticut, and it was a god-awful hellhole of spirituality. It was like the exact opposite. It was just grueling, you know, meetings with everybody talking about self-centered hobble-gobble. Oh, it was just... I just wanted to kill myself. And so me and a couple of other people that I had known for years, because they're in my sponsorship line, and you know, we started a big book group, and I found some decent groups, you know. It wasn't really that bad. But it wasn't home. And that job ended, and I raised my hand to my company, and I was just tired of them moving me all over hell and back. And so I go, you know, I'll be happy to work for you, but here's where I'm going to live. And they were good about it. They found me a job pretty close to around here, and I showed back up. And there's just something about New Jersey fellowship and people in New Jersey. I just love it, and I'm very, very grateful to come back. And I'm going back to meetings that I got sober at. There's this meeting in Basking Ridge on Monday night. It's called the Basking Ridge Beginners Meeting. And it's off the chain. Any particular night, there's 100 people in there, you know, 35 of them with less than 90 days. And it's really for the people that are new. And I need to be reminded constantly about, really, why am I here? You know, why, you know, what could happen? And like it wasn't too long ago that somebody raises his hand and said, you know, I had 90 days, but, you know, I drank today, you know, so now I have 89, you know. isn't that great? I understand the math, you know. That math is easy for me to understand. But you know, so that being said, you know, I'm glad to be back. That's the math that we got the ADD. I'm glad to be back here. Another thing that I did in my life is what I was doing was, I was, believe it or not, I went from a bad electrician, somebody that just blew crap up everywhere and just electrocuted not only myself but plumbers and, you know, all kinds of other people by accident. And that was my job when I got sober. I ended up, you know, getting promoted up over the years. And I ended up actually running pharmaceutical manufacturing sites and pharmaceutical research and development sites. I was the senior facility manager of these big pharma sites. And, you know, every day I went to work, I would say, they're going to find out. You know what I mean? They're gonna figure this mistake out. But I did pretty well with it. About 6 months ago, I was really tired of working that hard. I'm 62. I was just really tired of killing myself with 50 direct reports and budgets and, you know, every kind of deliverable and KPIs and SLAs and all this stuff. And I kind of jumped ship, and I took a job in corporate development with a company not far from here, where I really have a home office. I've got an office at the office, but I'm given a lot of flexibility to just there's a basic goal. Here's the basic goal. You know, we'll talk to you in a year. I mean, it's just so cool, and I'm really, really grateful about this particular job. You know, so that's really where I am and where I've been the last 5 years. Things have been going pretty well. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was looking around for a 12 and 12. I don't think there's one here. So I'm going to butcher it, but I'm going to.
You do?
Yeah. Oh, could I see it for a minute? There's two paragraphs I want to read out of there that I think are really going to set the stage for at least what I'm going to be going over in the next couple of weeks. It's the strategy, or it's the end game, or whatever you want to call it, but it's why we do these steps. And it says on the third paragraph, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature. If practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the user, the sufferer, to become happily and usefully whole. It's one of my favorite sentences in AA. And so the steps are a group of principles, and they're spiritual principles. And if we practice them as a way of life, they're going to do two things. They're going to expel that obsession to drink. What's the obsession to drink? How many times have you sworn off alcohol and meant it, and alcohol went back in your body? You know, if you're anything like me, every day that happened before I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really didn't want to drink. I was not stupid. I knew I was poisoning myself with alcohol. I knew I was pissing everybody off. I knew I was making myself ill. And I knew that it was very unpredictable, you know, what would happen once I started drinking. But I would do it every night. So these 12 steps are principles that if we practice them as a way of life, that's not going to happen to us anymore. We're gonna be able to remain separated from alcohol as long as we, you know, maintain this practicing of these principles, will be safe and protected from alcohol. I wanted that in a big way when I showed up here. But the best part is we will become happily and usefully whole. I always wanted to be happy. I always wanted to feel whole. I always wanted to have purpose in my life. I always wanted to feel like this all means something. You know, I'm contributing to the world in a very cool way, and I believe that these principles will do that for us. Now, let's look at the bad news. You always got to look at the bad news. I think it's our tradition. Give me one second. I think it's on 174. Yep, here it is. Okay. A unless each AA member follows to the best of their ability the suggested 12 steps to recovery, they almost certainly sign their own death warrant. Do you think they meant death warrant, Dave?
I don't think it's that bad.
You don't think it's that bad? So what if he really meant that? What, you know, this is Bill Wilson. What if he meant that, and what if it's true? Let's just consider that for a second, okay? If we don't practice these spiritual principles to the best of our ability, we sign our own death warrant. So just for argument's sake, let's say that's true. I believe it's true because I go to this beginner's meeting on Monday night, and practically every Monday night, somebody raises their hand and they say, I got drunk. I don't know what happened. And a lot of times they believe that they changed their mind about this AA thing. Okay, go to AA, stay away from alcohol, stop completely trashing your life and everybody who's close to you. Go get drunk and get a DUI. I mean, which of those is sane and which of those is insane? You know, our ego doesn't want us to believe we lack sanity, we lack power, we lack choice, we lack control. Our ego doesn't want us to believe that. Our ego wants us to think that we've changed our mind one more time and we're going to get drunk. But that's not what happens in alcoholism. It's a strange mental blank spot. It's a subtle form of insanity that precedes the drink that does not allow you to use sound judgment. And you go to the liquor store or you go to the cop man or whatever, and once more you're relapsing. You know, so it's saying that unless we practice these spiritual principles, we put ourselves on that ball field where that can happen. It also says, their drunkenness and disillusion are not penalties inflicted by people in authority. They result from the personal disobedience to spiritual principles. So if you've ever relapsed, you know, stop lying about, well, I relapsed because she left me. Well, you relapsed when she stayed. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I relapsed when I lost the job. Well, you relapsed when you got the job. It's not causal. We want it to be all the crap out there. You know, if you were married to the same person I was married, you'd drink too. It's not causal like that. Our drinking is based on personal disobedience to spiritual principles. That's the whole lesson in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, how do we apply this stuff? How do we apply these spiritual principles? That's really what we're doing in this big book workshop. What Dave and I do is, from our own personal experience and from the literature, you know, we try to explain in a way that's understandable at least how we've experienced these steps and how we take these steps. Dave was talking about having a learning disability. And, you know, I've got the exact same learning disability he has. I just saved money by having him go get diagnosed. Without exaggeration, I've been through the book. Without exaggeration, I've been through the book Alcoholics Anonymous 500 times. I'm not exaggerating. If you add up all the big book workshops I've done, all the people I've taken through the steps, all the times I've read it on my own, all the times I've listened to it on, you know, gazillions of CDs, I've at least been through this book 500 times. But there's people who can read this book twice and outquote me. You know, I can't quote this book. But I've been able to embrace this book. What I think going through the book that many times has enabled me to do is to develop a personal vocabulary about this work. I can explain from my own experience what the 11th step looks like, and some people can understand from that. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, and afraid? This is what I'm supposed to review at night. I do this at night. It comes automatically to me. There's a quiet period of time, you know, after everything is done and the stereo's off and the TV's off. There's a time when I look at this and I see this whole 11th step as a self-evaluation, self-reflection. If I don't understand what the problem is, as far as my spiritual development is concerned, if I don't understand what the problem is, I'm going to be working on the wrong solution. So the fourth step taught me to see what really is the problem. Oh, the problem, Dave, is I put a quart of vodka down my throat every night. And the cops, oh, they're terrible. And my family just doesn't understand me, and my boss is an idiot. You know, I mean, that's what I would tell you my problem was when I walked in here. That was so far from the truth of being my problem, it was unbelievable. My problem was I suffered from deep resentment. Deep resentment. My head would come off the pillow in the morning when I came to, and it would be like this. Those bastards! Maybe the first thought, you know? Like, sons of bitches! And then I would move about my day. You want to talk about a soul sickness? You know, how do you move forward from there? Fear. I misunderstood fear for a long, long time. I thought fear had to do with being a coward. And I was anything but a coward. I was a crazy man. I would do absolutely insane things, you know, with no regard for my own personal welfare. But how fear manifested in me was toxic anxiety when I was sober. Just not feeling comfortable with myself or my environment. Not being in the right place at the right time. Just wanting to go home. That's what my fear was. And I was covered with that. And every single year that went by, my life got smaller and smaller and smaller and had fewer people in it and less stuff and less hassle. I just don't want to be hassled. You know? I just want to be out of here, you know. And that's a manifestation of fear. They're asking us, are we afraid? Are we resentful? But we got to know what those are. Selfish. If you would have tried to pin selfish on me, I would have told you you're crazy. I bail people out of jail all the time. I share cocaine. You know, I'm not selfish. I mean, that's a friggin' delusion. It's a delusion. My whole world was built on selfishness. I went out with people who I figured would be good for me and make me feel good. I worked so that I could buy stuff that would make me feel good. I mean, you name it, I never did anything for anybody else unless there was something in it for me at a really deep level. But I was so selfish, I didn't even think I was selfish. I was so self-centered, I didn't know I was self-centered. Like somebody said to their sponsee one time, hey, you know, Dave, all those shadowy figures that you see out of the corner of your eye, they're people. You know?
I knew it.
I mean, seriously, you know, what is, you know, somebody die and I'd be pissed. Some bitch died on me. I gotta get dressed up now, and I don't do funerals. You know, I mean, just incredibly selfish. I didn't do paperwork. I don't do paperwork. You know, so I'd have to find somebody that would do my taxes or whatever. I paperwork, was a non-starter for me until I got sober. You know, what is that? What is that? That is toxic, critical, end-stage selfishness. And what I believe alcoholism is today, this is what I believe alcoholism is today. It's a manifestation of toxic selfishness that places us in a perception that we are apart from and not included in. We are not connected to, we are dislocated from. That's what I believe alcoholism is. And that is such a painful experience. We need to drink and we need to drug to not feel that. To just not feel that. And I had that from a young... I was born that way. I mean, I was born selfish. I was born apart from. I was born dislocated from. You know, because some of my earliest memories were, you know, school. There's a lot of people there. This isn't going to work for me, you know. I'm not going to do this. You know, look at all those scuttlefish happy to do this. What's wrong? What's wrong with me? I don't want to go. So I'm separated from, I'm on my own island. I think my problems are coming at me. I think the world, it's a hostile universe and I've just got to learn how to dodge and weave. And that's the way I see the world. And that's my alcoholism. Because the 12 steps are designed to heal that person. You know, I've told this story a bunch of times. I'm going to tell it again because Dave likes the way I tell it. My routine, the last 2 or 3 years of my drinking, my routine was this. I'd get off of my terrible job, drive my $100 car right to the liquor store. Just boom, right to the liquor store. And I had a routine. If it was the warm months, I would drink Gordon's vodka. If it was the cooler months, I would drink George Dickel bourbon. Those were my drinks. And I had one liquor store, and they would never run out of my brands because I had had that conversation with them. And they understood how important that was. So this one day, and here's the routine. I'd walk in, I knew right where I was, grab, go up, you know, have my 20, put the bottle down, 20 down, change, bag, out, right? It was very efficient. And for years, boom, 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 we didn't have to say a word, right? Boom, 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 it was done. It was a beautiful transaction. We understood each other at a very deep level. And this one day I go in, and there's somebody at the cash register before me. And it's a woman. And she's going to the guy who's going to ring me up. She's going, you know what kind of wine goes with tilapia? And all right, I'm like this. And he goes, oh, there's this marvelous vintage out of the California regions, and it has a wonderful blush. Let me take you over and show you. And he starts taking this woman and showing her all these bottles of wine. And I'm standing there like this. Hey! Are you crazy? I'm vodka buyer! You know, I'm saying this to him. I'm vodka buyer, like that should trump everything, right? Come on, vodka buyer! And give that lady a bottle of Gallo and get her the hell out of here! You know what I mean? I've got a problem here! I got a problem here! I'm sober! Now think about that, because when he finally got done with this lady and boom, 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 we got our transaction, I was out the door with the brown paper bag and the bottle of vodka, it was like, oh. Now, if alcohol, tell me this, how much alcohol do you have to drink to be an alcoholic? There's no answer to that, because alcohol is a symptom. The guy behind the tilapia lady is the alcoholic. And when I walk out of there with the alcohol, and I go, ah, oh, I'm recognizing alcohol as a solution to alcoholism, as a treatment for alcoholism, because it was. It's just a really bad one. It's a terrible one. You know, because it just, it catches up with you, you become addicted to it, it becomes progressive, and it kills you. But what was deep within me, what was deep within me that was wrong? What was deep within me that was wrong? What did alcohol make right? It made right that uncomfortable, feeling uncomfortable with myself and my environment, the self-centered fear, the resentment, the feeling apart from and dislocated from. That's the alcoholism. And that's what these steps do. Now, I've gone through a four-step. I've identified my anger, my fear, and the guilt, the shame, and the remorse that I feel, because if you drank like I did, you hurt people. And I didn't want to hurt people. I've shared all this stuff. I've recognized the fact that these defects of character are much too large for me to just chip away at on my own. This is not a self-help program. If this was a self-help program, we'd be in a lot of trouble because we're powerless and no human power can relieve us of our alcoholism. It's not a self-help program. So I recognize that God is going to, the actual power of God, divine providence is what is going to have to work in me and through me for me to heal. That's what's going to have to happen. I recognize that in step six. I humbly ask God in step seven to, you know, please make that possible. In step eight, I write a list of the people in the institutions that my defects of character have harmed. I go out and I actually make amends to those people. I start living reactively in step 10. And now I'm at a place where it's time for me to broaden and deepen my spiritual life. To get deeper involved with this power that is keeping me separated from alcohol. This power that's enabling me to practice this spiritual life. And with a spiritual life, things get better in your life. You live a spiritual life, your life is going to get better. So when I'm looking at step 11 has been my favorite step for 20 years. Because it's a broadening and deepening step. It's a growth step. It's every single time I approach the 11th step, it reminds me one more time that there is divine providence, there's the power of God, there is the sunlight of the Spirit, there is the Father of light, there is the great reality that is working in my life to help change my life and help direct my life. And the more I stay out of the way of that power, the better my life gets. And step 11 is upon awakening, as I move through the day and retiring at night, I'm going back into the disciplines of step 11 to remind myself one more time that I need this power. I on my own, without this power, what's going to happen is, even if I don't drink right away, I go back to the guy behind the tilapia lady. And that's not a life that's worth living. You know, it's not a life that's worth living. So I read a sentence, Dave.
Are you sure you're done? Do we owe an apology? I don't know about you guys, but I have found a very awkward time in recovery where I owe too many apologies. I want to give you an example of an apology that I had to go through. I'm sitting at work, and I'm booking a trip. Right? I'm sure that's what they pay me for. Right? But I'm at work, and I'm booking a trip, and I click the button, and I suddenly realize I have booked the wrong days, and I have booked first class. Right? Now, this reading disability apparently has been with me for a long time. So, what do? I think to myself, I'm screwed. I immediately go to that place. You ever know, like, alcoholism has me screwed by everybody but me. Right? Somehow I'm not going to be able to get out of this stuff. Some crap. And there's no cancel button. You ever like go back on the email? There's no cancel button. They got your money now, and you're done, right? And I was like, shit, I'm going to call them, right? You've reached American Airlines, and we have unusually long wait times.
Dun, dun, 6 days. Dun,
6 days, yeah. I'm like, so for 38 minutes, I'm on the phone, and I'm coming up with new lies to tell them so I can get out of this, you know, $2,000 flight to Atlanta. And I've come up with all this stuff, and I'm listening to this goddamn music. Goddamn music. When we get on the phone, I go, you know, I got to tell you, I have a problem. She goes, what's your problem? So I booked a first class ticket to Atlanta, and I meant to do it on this date, and I meant to go use my points. She goes, oh, no problem. You have 24 hours to cancel. And I go, oh, somehow I'm not happy about that. Because I had been attached to this idea that I should have some control. The hours that we squander are based upon this idea that I have some form of power. Any form of power, that's the delusion, right? That I have some power. In the book, Bill, one of the single worst things, right, that Bill ever wrote, in my opinion, up until about 5 or 6 years ago, was God is either everything or he is nothing. And my response to that was, well, fuck you, Bill. You know? You know, what's this absolute shit? Because I didn't have God, right? So I guess that's about 8 years ago now. Here's the funny thing. As I start to go through this process of doing an 11-step every night, I start to realize that the things that I held important to myself aren't true. And each time that these fall apart and are cast away, I also begin to realize I have less and less power. Right? And finally, when I get to that place where I suddenly realize I literally have no power, right? That the only thing required of me is to have faith, and faith in that which I don't have power, right? That sentence actually makes sense to me finally. That God is everything, but not everything to me, but literally everything. Now, that's my own understanding, right? It doesn't have to be yours. You can have any understanding you want. That's the beautiful part about Alcoholics Anonymous. But in that space, I no longer have duality. I'm no longer separate from God, where God's over here and has power and I don't. Right? The lack of power I have is because I have this misalignment with the truth. Right? The lady with the asking about the tilapia is the problem. This is a misalignment with the truth, you know, that doesn't work for me. Right? It's in this place where the world is not acting or treating me correctly that I end up getting in trouble with people. Now, another story was I bought one of these fancy laptops in, I don't want to say it was 2006 or 2007. It's when they first started putting cell phones in laptops. You guys remember that? They stopped doing that. But you used to be able to buy a laptop and put a chip in from your AT&T store or your Verizon store and be able to take your laptop around. And you know, this is before the advent of, you know, widespread Wi-Fi and everything else. So I get the box, and it comes with instructions, which I don't read, because I'm smarter than that, and that's for those people, right? And I put the laptop together, I put the chip in, I turn the laptop on, and it doesn't connect. So it's not my fault. I go to work, and I'm playing with it while they're paying me, and it's not connecting, right? I come home from work early, because I have to take care of this. It's not connecting. I go to the AT&T store, I burn up about an hour and 45 minutes of a text time. He goes, your chip's fine. He literally took it out, got me a brand new chip, looked at it literally like in a binary way, put it back in my laptop, put it in my phone, worked on my phone, didn't work in the laptop. He goes, yeah, it's got to be IBM. So okay, I get on the phone with IBM. I'm an hour on the phone with tech support there. And I'm blistering into the guy. And I hang up the phone, I go, oh, these people are just the worst. Because I want to be important. I want to have a laptop that has a phone built in. I turn the laptop over. I unscrew the back, and I realize I had never connected two wires to the chip. And it was like one of those moments. I think most of us have had this in AA where we go, I own amends. I own amends. I am literally the biggest idiot walking this earth right now. I get on the phone. I call back IBM. And I say, hey, yeah, so I was just on the phone with one of your techs, and I gave him a really hard time, and I was really bad, and I want to make an amends to the guy. He goes, you know, I'm that tech supervisor. And we've been talking about you. He goes, you're all good. I was like the test case on how to keep your cool when working with an idiot. So the question is, why does an apology come up in the first place? And for me, it's when I have attached myself to an outcome, when I've attached myself to something that I have no control over. I literally have no control over anything. Everything in my life is a gift, and it's not of my own making. I have no part in my life. Neither the good parts nor the bad parts. I created nothing. I've destroyed nothing. I'm along for the ride. You know, God has given me every single gift that I have. Right? I'm the only person who has spent time not recognizing it when it was clear as day to everybody else. Right? And that was one of the great things about having taken that that reading disability test, the language test, was it suddenly unfolded for me what my life looked like and why I always had this kind of low self-esteem attached to how I performed in school, because I knew I was kind of smart. I mean, mid-level cocaine trafficking doesn't come with an owner's manual, right? You got to kind of learn that on the fly. Got to put the gun in your pocket, got to roll on with the cash and the Colombians, and you got to survive. There's no reading involved. And that's kind of like why I gravitated towards some of those things. The higher the risk and the more it required us to think without reading made sense to me. And now I understand why, finally. And this is a gift. This understanding is an absolute gift. I would not have had this gift if I hadn't come here and you people were here and this book were here and all these opportunities to grow were here. And the growth comes from shedding self through the 11th step as well as the 4th step and being an active action in the 12th step and being useful. And I think I'm going to end there. So it's either you or open it up.
Open it up.
Open it up.